أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.
We're back for another episode of Islam in Focus. Assalamu alaikum, peace be unto you. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our 12th program, 12th and concluding program in our series dealing with the political system of Islam. Today we'll be discussing the rights of non-Muslim minorities in an Islamic state. I have joining me on the program Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Before we get into today's program, I wonder if I could have you very quickly summarize the main points that we touched on in our program last week.
Okay, the main focus of the program last week was, instead of going into finer details as to how the how exactly an ideal Islamic state should run, we talked about the guiding principles within which the implementation can be made
depending on the circumstances of time and place. And in this we discussed in some detail the importance of justice as a fundamental principle and the various levels of implementation of justice, individual, family, state, universal, or world justice. We talked also about human equality, that it's not equality of one group or the other, but human equality for all. And we talked about its ideological foundation from the Quran and prophetic sayings. And we discussed also the concept of freedom, but not just as a broad concept. We talked about the various implementation of freedom, like freedom of religion, freedom of expression, privacy, freedom of work and movement, and similar aspects. And of course, the freedom of the person, like the habeas corpus. Mm-hmm. A person should not be arrested or detained in an arbitrary manner without any specific charge. In each of these, we tried to show the roots of it and how would it be when committed Muslims sincerely implement those principles.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, when the term Islamic State is used, a common question arises with respect to the non-Muslims in that state. Can you explain the situation of the non-Muslims in an Islamic State?
Sometimes, like you said, Brother Hamid, there seem to be fears, or what I call perhaps undue fears, that if you have a true and sincere Islamic State, that there will be persecution, or that there is no place for non-Muslim minorities. This is not what Islam teaches. Indeed, it is true, to start with, that an Islamic state is not a secular state. It's not like a typical secular state where God is kept away from the picture. It is, yes, an ideological state. And usually you can't have an Islamic state unless you have the majority of people believing in that faith and are committed to implement the teaching of their faith in their moral, individual, social, economic, and political life as well.
Mm-hmm.
So being an ideological state is not the same thing as exclusivist state, which is designed only to serve their own citizens or their own community of believers at the expense of others. So that does not mean at all that non-Muslim minorities are to be annihilated or gotten rid of. This is not what Islam teaches at all. In fact, the Quran does not only speak about tolerating non-Muslim minorities under an ideal Islamic state. Beyond toleration even, it talks about the establishment of cordial and friendly relationship with them. I recall that in one of the earlier programs in the second series on the question of topic of prophethood, with a specific reference to the later programs, I think program 9, which dealt with the relationship between Muslims and non-Muslims, it was indicated clearly and documented amply from the Quran that God does not want us as Muslims to have any bad relationship with non-Muslims who are not fighting us and who are not really hurting the cause of Muslims. Just to remind, since it has been several years back since this was discussed, in chapter 60, for example, in the Quran, verses 8 and 9, لَا يَنْهَاكُمُ اللَّهُ عَنِ الَّذِينَ لَمْ يُقَاتِلُكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ. This verse basically says that God does not forbid you, O Muslims, as to those who are not fighting you to suppress your faith or drive you away from your home, that you should be kind, just and equitable with them, because God loves those who are just. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a matter of toleration, it even calls on friendly relationship, particularly in the case of the people of the book, i.e. people like Jews and Christians who share a lot with Muslims in terms of believing God, the hereafter and moral teachings and so on. We find that the Quran addresses them even specially as the people of the book. And like I said, there were more details to document and support this particular statement. Indeed, I may add here, since we're talking about the political system in Islam, that the very term used to refer to non-Muslim minorities living under the protection of Islamic State, the very term itself, dhimmi, is an expression of this principle of tolerance and friendship.
Mm-hmm. Well, to give us perhaps a better appreciation of that, can you explain what the term dhimmi means?
Well, dhimmi comes from the Arabic term dhimma, which means pledge or covenant. So a dhimmi, a person who is dhimmi, let's say a non-Muslim living under an Islamic state, is called dhimmi because it means he is a covenanted person. A person who had the covenant and pledge, as the Muslim jurists define it, the pledge and covenant of Allah, of His Messenger, and of the believers, that he would be protected and he would live in freedom and dignity under an Islamic rule. So the term itself is so beautiful in its implication. It's basically an expression of the right to guarantee their rights and freedoms.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, some Orientalists draw an analogy between Islam's position concerning minorities and Roman law. What is your comment on that?
Well, there is a great deal of erroneous analogy that the Orientalists sometimes draw. A good discussion of that particular topic was made by a legal authority, Dr. Sharif Al-Basyuni, and his article titled Islam, Concept, Law, and World Habeas Corpus was published in the Rutgers Camden Law Journal in the fall of 1969. And briefly speaking, there are two basic reasons why this analogy is not correct. Without getting into technical details, I think people in the legal profession can understand and appreciate this quick reference. Number one, unlike the Romans consider themselves, Muslims do not regard themselves, quote-unquote, the lords of the population of the globe, a concept that was predominant among the Romans, that they are the masters of the world. As indicated in the moral teaching of Islam, that a human being regards himself, a Muslim should regard himself, in fact, as the servant of God, as the slave of God, if you will, if you use the term in a positive sense, in terms of obedience to God, but not above other people. A second reason why it's not a right analogy is that non-Muslims living under Islamic State are not regarded technically as outside jurisdiction, as we find, for example, in the so-called Pax Romana, or the Roman peace dictated on the subjugated people. Indeed, it is emphasized that the Muslim and the dhimmi, the Muslim and non-Muslim under the Islamic State, are equal before the law in every respect. So that led the Dr. Basyuni to conclude that the distinction then between Muslim and dhimmi is not a distinction really in terms of rights, but rather, as you call it, the distinction remains one of political administration in terms of the political and legislative process, and not of of human rights. And in that sense, in fact, you can say that minorities under Islamic rule, in fact, enjoy more privileges than even under the contemporary democratic system.
Now, that's a very interesting and challenging statement that you make. How can you justify it? Can it be justified?
It might sound too exaggerated, eh?
Mm.
Well, to start with, as discussed in the previous question, first of all, whether a person is a Muslim or non-Muslim, he is equal before the law. And in that sense, that would be similar with the quote-unquote democratic or secular systems today. But another important thing to keep in mind is that the mere designation of dhimmi, a covenanted people, a people of the pledge, shows even more sensitivity and more care, special care, given to safeguarding the rights of those minorities. In other words, instead of saying, you know, cover your eye or conceal the truth and say, no, everybody is the same. Minorities are minorities. The very fact that there is sensitivity and special covenant and special pledge shows sensitivity to their needs and their rights. Another point to relate here is that the obligation to be just and equitable with minorities is not just a legal responsibility as we find it under secular systems. In the case of Islam, it is both legal and moral, based and religious, based on the teaching and commandments of God and the Prophet. And that gives it a much more stronger motivating force than simply the law says this, because you can do things behind the back of the law without being caught. But it's a moral and religious part of the orientation of the individual. Fourthly, and that's perhaps the most important point so far, is that the rights and guarantees accorded to non-Muslim minorities under Islamic State come originally from the word of God and the saying of the Prophet, which are unchangeable by humans. And that makes a big difference from democracies. Democracies can sit down in a legislative assembly and say, right, we'll guarantee the rights of minorities in XYZ. But, at least theoretically, the same assembly who acknowledges the right of minorities also have the right to take away those rights, to rescind.
Override.
Exactly, to override, to rescind this. You can say, right, but there are constitutions. So what? Constitutions also could be amended under certain requirements. Whereas in Islam, the rights are given by God and His Messenger, and as we said before, in Islamic law, nobody has the right to supersede the word of God, which means nobody can ever claim the right to deprive minorities of those rights as enshrined and guaranteed in Islamic law. So when the person really is designated as a dhimmi or a covenanted person, it means that he has the freedom to also follow his personal law, and that's another major difference. You see, if you have a religious minority under Islamic State, Islam does not say you must get married or divorce or follow the law of inheritance as everybody else. They have even a special privilege, and that privilege is not there in democratic systems. You see, a Jew or Muslim, for example, living in a recent, a contemporary democracy in Canada, US, or Britain, cannot say, right, apply my Jewish law or my Muslim law of inheritance, because it, as a secular state, it says everybody is the same, it's part of the civil law. In Islam, it respects more the religious sentiments of people and say, right, on personal matter, personal law, if you will, you can follow your own. And that, I suppose, is a fair documentation that it is even above guarantees and freedoms given in a democratic system. The only difference perhaps remains what we mentioned early when we defined the Islamic State, is that Islam addresses the issue honestly. It does not presume that a state which constitutes a large majority of Muslim would be ruled by a non-Muslim because it is an ideological state, and there is no apology for that. And as I said in previous program also, it would be rather just cosmetic to say anyone can become president, because no Buddhist or Muslim will ever be the president of United States, or the Prime Minister of Canada, or the Prime Minister of Britain. Being an ideological state ruled by the Quran, it has to have at least one person to rule who believes in what he's implementing. But this does not mean that non-Muslim minorities have no right for other positions, including the highest ministerial positions. And this was done, actually, in history. So actually, if you look at it in terms of the total rights and guarantees, it's even more than democracies.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you mentioned earlier that Vimy means a pledge or a covenant of protection. Would you explain what that protection entails, what protection is afforded to a Vimy?
Well, as a broad subdivision, some jurists put it in terms of two aspects of protection, external and internal. External means to protect the non-Muslim minorities against any danger coming from outside of the state. And let me just give a couple of illustrations made by some famous Muslim jurists to indicate what is meant by external protection. Ibn Hazm, for example, said that if in our country or our Islamic state we have some non-Muslim minorities or dhimmis, covenanted people, and then an enemy came to attack, not he wants to attack us, but he wanted particularly to attack the non-Muslim minority, he says in this case, even though he's not attacking us as Muslims, we are required to fight him and to prevent and defend the non-Muslim covenanted person with all our might, or else we would have betrayed our trust and our covenant to protect him according to the law of Allah and His Messenger. Mm-hmm. So see the extent to which Ibn Taymiyyah, another famous Muslim jurist, during the Tartar invasion, he went to their leader to spare the suffering of the people. So the Tartar leader said to Ibn Taymiyyah, the Muslim jurist, he said, all right, I can give you the guarantees and protection for Muslims only. And he did not like it. He said, no, that does not please us. He said, the other Christian and Jewish families are also under our protection, and if you want to give the protection, you must give protection to all. So he defended their rights, even though any person, of course, under this circumstance would say, all right, I'll save my skin or my people's skin. But he refused, and he insisted that we should should cover all of them. As far as the internal protection or guarantees, it includes protection from any form of tyranny internally within the state, like the protection of their lives, the protection of their property, honor, dignity, and personal freedom.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I'd like to have you elaborate a little bit on this latter form of protection, perhaps showing the attitude of Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, his attitude towards non-Muslim minorities.
Well, in terms of the Prophet's attitude, we can look at it in terms both in words and deeds. In his own words, one of his sayings, as narrated in At-Tabarani, he says, whoever hurts a covenanted person, a dhimmi, then he is hurting me, and whoever is hurting me, he is hurting, or in a sense displeasing Allah.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the nobility of the expression. The Prophet himself, the Prophet of Islam, is putting himself in the same position as a dhimmi, and whoever hurts the dhimmi is hurting the Prophet himself. In another saying, he said that whoever hurts a covenanted non-Muslim, I will be his complainant, that is the complainant of the non-Muslim, and whoever I have been his complainants, I will ask for his right in the day of judgment. So he would be like the advocate of the non-Muslim. In another saying also of the Prophet, he said that whoever committed any act of oppression or injustice to a person who has a treaty with the Muslims or have under Muslim protection, or took away part of his right, or charged him with something that he could not do in terms of labor or other requirements, or took him anything without his consent, then I will be his complainant in the day of judgment. There are too many, and just for the brevity of time, I just give this as indication of the theme of the prophetic saying on that subject. As far as his deeds, there are numerous, and perhaps I could give you a couple of, or one at least, example of the Prophet's guarantees. First of all, for the Christians in Najran, in Yemen, the Prophet provided a charter which gave them again all their freedoms, the religious freedom to run their own, you know, personal affairs. And even in one famous document is the document pertaining to the covenant that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, gave to the monks and priests in the St. Catherine's, which is near Mount Sinai, in Sinai, what is now Egypt, to all Christians. Perhaps a review of some of the items could be quite revealing. One, the priests and monks are not to be unfairly taxed. Secondly, no bishop is to be driven out of his bishopric. Three, no Christian is to be forced to reject his religion, even to become Muslim, cannot force. Four, no monk to be expelled from his monastery. Five, the pilgrims who want to go to Jerusalem, for example, are not to be detained from their pilgrimage. Six, no church can be pulled down for the sake of building Muslim mosques, places of worship, or Muslim homes. That's not permissible. Seven, the Christian women married to Muslims or Muslim husbands are to fully enjoy their faith and their practice without pressure or intimidation. Well, the eighth condition is even more revealing. It says, should the priests and monks need funds or need help to repair and fix their churches, it should be provided. I don't know where else, and we're talking here the 7th century, where else in the 20th century even do you find this kind of spirit of tolerance and respect of others?
Well, I think this discussion has clarified many of the common misconceptions about Islam, particularly with respect to non-Muslims. However, there's one more issue that we haven't touched on, and that is the question of jizya. Some state that Muslims levied taxes on Muslims, those who
taxes on non-Muslims,
on non-Muslims rather, those who did not embrace Islam as a form of punishment. What is your comment on that?
It has absolutely nothing to do with punishment at all. First of all, jizya is a tax which is levied on non-Muslims living under the protection of an Islamic state. The reason why it has nothing to do with punishment or intimidation or pressure of people to embrace Islam, which is contrary, of course, to what we already discussed in the previous program, the freedom of religion and practice of one's own faith. But some people like take one part, one aspect of Islamic law and leave the other. Under Islamic law, in an Islamic state, all residents, Muslims and non-Muslims, are entitled to social security and are entitled to the protection of the state. Now, it should not be forgotten that Muslims, the Muslim citizens, if you will, are required legally and religiously, both, to pay zakah, which I translated in a previous program as institutionalized charity. And that is a percentage of the excess funds they have beyond their basic needs. It's about, let's say, 2.5% as a minimum. It could be more than that. It varies also with the source of income. And that requirement is enforceable by law. If people refuse to pay it, the Islamic State can actually force people to pay. Now, a non-Muslim who gets all the benefits of being a citizen under the protection and social security of an Islamic state is not required to pay zakah. You might say, why? Why can't we treat everybody equally? The reason is that if you require a non-Muslim to pay zakah, zakah is religiously oriented. It is a religious duty. And that person does not believe in Islam to start with.
Mm-hmm.
So out of sensitivity to his own beliefs, respect of his own orientation, you cannot force a non-Muslim pay what is essentially a religious duty. But in the meantime, it would be unfair also for him to get all the benefits without sharing in the cost of those benefits. So instead of forcing him to pay zakah, he has to pay another tax called jizya, which is just like to make up for what Muslims already contribute to the state. The other aspect also that could be related here is that under Islamic system, a non-Muslim cannot be forced to have the compulsory service in the army or conscription. Again, that's sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
Because he would be fighting under a Muslim army for a cause that he may or may not necessarily sympathize with. So out of respect for that sensitivity also, or sensibility, he does not have to participate in the army, but like many countries have, like a sort of part of the taxes for defense purposes. So he has to contribute also for the defense to which he is entitled in terms of protection of the state. That's why some jurists actually say that if a person wants to serve in the army voluntarily, a non-Muslim, and he's taken or accepted in the army, then there's no jizya that he'll be required. Some jurists even went as far as saying that if a non-Muslim offers a good service, something useful to the Muslim community, the jizya also could be waived or could be removed from him. Another aspect to remember is that jizya was a very small thing. Some scholars estimated as like a few dollars per year, and it varied depending on the financial status of the individual. And furthermore, in the law of jizya, and there are lots of discussions of that in an interesting book called Al-Kharaj by Abu Yusuf, we're talking about the revenues of the states and so on. Jizya is not supposed to be imposed on women, on children, on old people, and on anyone who cannot earn because of temporary or permanent disability.
Mm-hmm.
And even then we talk about like a few dollars really per year. Not only this, some jurists even go to the point of saying that if the state feels that there is no need even to collect jizya from non-Muslims, if they are resourceful enough, they say that jizya after all is not mandatory, it's optional, and it could be waived also if there is no need for it, notwithstanding the benefits that citizens, not Muslims or non-Muslims, can get living under an Islamic state. So it's obvious then, I hope, that jizya is neither a punishment nor even an enticement to become a Muslim. Mm-hmm. You know, if a non-Muslim becomes a Muslim, he would have even more financial obligations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look into the structure of zakah, he will even be paying more as a Muslim than paying jizya as a non-Muslim. Of course, that presumes that those who implement the law are also sincere and are doing that in justice and fairness to all, not to abuse that discretion of collecting these taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, again, being fair to Muslims, fairness applies to both, and if you have unjust rulers, they probably be unjust to both,
mm-hmm.
Muslims and non-Muslims alike. So this question is not just a matter of a statement. It is something which is documented in history, and there are ample evidence of how it was implemented and recognized even by non-Muslims.
Mm-hmm. In the closing minute of today's program, is there any final comment that you might want to make with respect to the tolerance of Muslims towards non-Muslims?
Well, if we had more time, I had with me here a document with a Xerox copy of facsimile, a document that goes back to the 12th century, in which one of the head of the Nestorian church said it clearly and obviously. He said Muslims do not hate us, they do not oppose us, and he said they allow us to practice our faith freely, they respect us and our honor and dignity, and he admitted that they give us even help and financial support for our own churches. In fact, the document also is found in more than one museum in Britain, in Arabic, and the translation is very amazing in terms of the kind of guarantees and tolerance that was afforded non-Muslims, something that, to the best of my information, is unparalleled. in history, past or present.
Well, thank you, Brother Jamal. We want to invite you back next week when we'll start our new series, our 10th in this series dealing with topics in Islam. We'll be discussing the sources of Islam. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله.